It began on May 9th with a video posted on TikTok.
TikTok video of a vaccinated woman putting a magnet on her arm and it was sticking to her. It was a baby Yoda refrigerator magnet.
Now, that woman in the video claimed that the COVID-19 vaccine can cause a person to become magnetized. That is not true. Magnets do not stick to people who have been vaccinated. But Imran Amin, CEO of the Center for Countering Digital Hate, an international nonprofit that analyzes and combats online misinformation, he says that by the time TikTok removed the video just 4 days later, it had already been viewed almost 10 million times.
Then you have other people jumping on it as well, trying to sort of get their bit of the fame, because that's how social media works. We're all trying to go viral, aren't we? And so you had a proliferation of videos in the magnet challenge, jumping between platforms, going in Spanish content, in Mandarin language content.
The posts that followed the magnet challenge either mocked or tried to confirm the original video. But ultimately, despite their intent, they all had the same effect. A nitro boost, further amplifying the disinformation.
Then it really took off. June the 8th is when Sherry Tenpenny, one of the disinformation dozen, appeared in front of the Ohio State Legislature and said,
"I'm sure you've seen the pictures all over the internet of people who've had these shots and now they're magnetized. They can put a key on their forehead, it sticks. They can put spoons and forks all over them and they can stick because now we think that there's a metal piece to that."
Tenpenny is an American osteopathic physician and an anti-vaccine advocate based in Cleveland. She's the author of a book opposing vaccines. And when the fact-checking site PolitiFact analyzed her statements, they found 99% of them to be entirely false. But the magnet story was pernicious. So much that the CDC released a bulletin saying, quote, "All COVID-19 vaccines are free from metals such as iron, nickel, cobalt, lithium, and rare earth alloys. In addition, the typical dose for a COVID-19 vaccine is less than a milliliter, which is not enough to allow magnets to be attracted to your vaccination site, even if the vaccine was filled with a magnetic metal, which it is not." But of course, that fact alone is not enough to stop the spread of disinformation. That is not how online chaos confuses the mind. Imran Ahmed says, "We're living in a world where small seeds of doubt can overwhelm a person's willingness to believe verifiable information."
A few people will have just thought, crumbs, well, if I get the vaccine, maybe I'll become magnetic. Now, of course, that's non-falsifiable because they have no way of checking that. Unless they start finding people who've been vaccinated and sticking keys to them and saying, look, it makes them magnetic.
And that is what makes people especially vulnerable to disinformation in a pandemic.
Often it's said that conspiracy theories have at their core a kernel of truth. That's not true. Every conspiracy theory at its heart contains a leap of faith. And they can give you answers, therefore, to things that fact-based evidence, science, can often struggle to because it's trying to work out what is going on. And so in a moment of great anxiety, conspiracy theories are so, because they're not rooted in truth, they can fill the gap faster than truth can.
And they are filling that gap with high speed right now. In March, Ahmed's group, the Center for Countering Digital Hate, published a report showing that just 12 accounts, just 12, are behind 65% of all anti-vaccine disinformation proliferating on social media. Most of them are still there. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today on Point, we're going to talk about the so-called disinformation dozen. And to help us do that, John Gregory joins us. He's deputy editor of health at NewsGuard, a group that rates the reliability of information on 6,000 different sites. He's the co-author of another report titled "The COVID-19 Vaccine Misinformation Super Spreaders." John Gregory, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so 12. Roughly 12 accounts are responsible for some 65% of all anti-vaccine disinformation. That's from the Center for Countering Digital Hate. Does that match with your analysis of where a lot of the anti-vaccine untruths are coming from?
Those are certainly some of the most prolific and kind of established sources in the anti-vaccine world. They're not alone in spreading anti-vaccine misinformation on Facebook or on any other platform. Our earlier report, which predated when the COVID-19 vaccines were widely available, they were still in, you know, only available to someone in clinical trials. We cataloged 34 pages on Facebook, you know, with followings ranging from the, you know, a little bit under 100,000 to the millions. And of those 34 pages, 24 of them are still active today, and there is some overlap with the disinformation dozen, like Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s Children's Health Defense and the Truth About Cancer group. But out of the 34, we identified a larger subset that were spreading misinformation about the vaccines before anyone outside of a trial could get them. 24 are still active, and 17 of the 22 of them we identified outside the U.S., are still active. A few more of them were taken down from, you know, if they were US-based pages.
Okay. So, but still, it's a relatively small number being responsible for what seems like an overwhelming majority of, are we talking about the sources of disinformation or how they're proliferating? I mean, how do we sort of understand their impact in spreading this stuff through the information circulation system?
The way we understand it is looking at both their reach and then the interactions they gain on individual pieces of content. They're not always the original source. In fact, a lot of times they're just the amplifiers. They use some other source, another website, a YouTube video, another, especially if it's someone with medical credentials, that always seems to help their case. And then they just amplify that on their pages. And that's really where it takes off. They don't always have to be the ones originating the misinformation, but they're the ones where they're going to expose more people to it because of their broad reach and kind of established being an established voice to the vaccine hesitant and anti-vaxxers.
Okay, so a combination of factors there. So can we talk a little bit more specifically about who some of the primary people are? I mean, you mentioned Robert Kennedy Jr. I mean, remind folks about why he's a central figure in this. And then also go ahead and name some of the other sources here that you've focused on.
Sure. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is probably the most prominent name in the anti-vaccine community simply because of the name value he brings, being one of the sons of Robert F. Kennedy and being Robert F. Kennedy Jr. kind of boosts his profile. And he can appeal to, I think, a broad set of people because of the Kennedy name brand. He can be trusted by both sides of the political aisle. And he's also built up a reputation before he got into the anti-vaccine movement as someone who was kind of a consumer watchdog. He was involved in cases on environmental law and trying to expose companies that were putting waste into the environment illegally. And I think that gave him a level of trust, which he now exploits to promote anti-vaccine misinformation. And his group, Children's Health Defense, is actually one of the largest, you know, really health-focused, really anti-vaccine-focused sites that NewsGuard sees in terms of Facebook interactions. They're up in the top 600 of all news sites in terms of Facebook interactions. So that name brand, that name recognition with the Kennedy name and just his established reach really helps him put these things out. Another one of the disinformation.
Well, actually, can I just jump in here? Sorry,
sure.
Sorry. Can I just jump in here? Because I think it's helpful to also provide an example or two of exactly what these accounts and these folks are saying, just so we can sort of deconstruct them a little bit. So here's Robert F. Kennedy Jr. in a Facebook video from October of 2020, and the video is titled Global Resistance, and he's making unverified claims about the COVID-19 vaccine.
We have 1.6 million people die every year from tuberculosis. We're not wearing masks. We're not on lockdown. What's the difference between tuberculosis and coronavirus? Tuberculosis has a vaccine. And the vaccine costs about $3. And that's why we're not on lockdown. because nobody is making $39 a vaccine or $300 a vaccine the way that Moderna and AstraZeneca and Johnson are making from this catastrophe.
Okay, so let me ask you, what exactly is disinformation about what Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is saying there?
It would be taking out the context of why is a vaccine that's existed for many more years than the COVID vaccines, the tuberculosis vaccine, why is that less expensive? What it goes into its development and things like that. It can sound rational, but it's really just a oversimplification to come to his predetermined point that, oh, this is all to benefit the pharma companies rather than providing, you know, needed context about why that would be, or even explaining that, you know, this is not getting to the fact that there's nothing to back up his claim other than this very spurious argument and this leap of faith he's taking.
Right. So that's a key thing that in most of the disinformation, or a lot of it that I've seen here, stripping the context out is a critical part of it, right? Because context, of course, in a sense, complicates things and makes it harder to come to, as you pointed out, your predetermined point here. And in fact, by not including that context, he sort of insinuates nefarious intent, right? By both, I guess, the government and pharmaceutical companies here. Do we see that pattern in other spreaders of anti-vaccine disinformation?
Absolutely. It's really taking that, you know, predetermined conclusion and working backwards, and whatever little dots you can connect to come back to that point that you've already decided you're going to promote, that's really part and parcel with a lot of their strategies.
Okay, so John Gregory, stand by here for a second. John is deputy editor of health at NewsGuard, and we're talking about the small group of very powerful spreaders of disinformation about the COVID vaccine, how they're doing it, why they're doing it, and the impact that they're having. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are talking about the fact that a tiny number of individuals and individual accounts on social media are responsible for the majority of anti-vaccine disinformation out there. And it is a case study about the major impact on public health, on global public health, that a small group of determined folks can have through social media. And we're talking today with John Gregory. He's senior analyst and deputy editor of health at NewsGuard. It's an organization that analyzes the trustworthiness of 6,000 websites across the world. And he co-authored a report titled COVID-19 Vaccine Misinformation Super Spreaders. And let's talk about another one of those super spreaders here. This is Joseph Mercola. And can you just tell us quickly, before I play something that Mercola has said, who is he?
Joseph Mercola is an osteopathic physician who has kind of built an empire based on spreading health misinformation and sowing distrust in traditional medicine. His website, on top of having a prolific archive of articles about, you know, various natural health remedies and even diving into some health-related conspiracy theories, he sells a lot of supplements and treatments and medical products through his website that have garnered him a net worth well over $100,000, according to a Washington Post article from 2019. So he's really created an empire based on spreading false health information to people and saying, you can only trust me, not your regular doctor, not the health authorities.
Okay, so he's got a clear financial incentive here. So here's a little bit of the kinds of things Mercola has been saying about COVID. This is from an episode of a show called Bulletproof Radio from April of this year. And Mercola is talking about the use of nebulized hydrogen peroxide, which is a bleaching agent and has no sort of medically approved use in terms of battling COVID. But he says he thinks it's an effective non-drug treatment for COVID.
This is a proactive preventive therapy, and that is nebulization of hydrogen peroxide. I know it sounds simple, maybe foolish, but it works. And I'm telling you, I've never seen anything more effective in my entire clinical career for the treatment of viral upper respiratory infection. There is nothing better than this.
Again, hydrogen peroxide, bleaching agent, and the medical community overall continues to support vaccination as the best treatment or best preventative protection against COVID-19. John, you had mentioned also earlier that the medical credentials of some of these disinformation super spreaders, as you put it, is one of the things that helps speed their information across social media. And here, I mean, Mercola's specifically talking about never seeing anything more effective in his entire clinical career. I mean, is he just making that up, or is he actually talking? How do we know if he's actually talking about cases that he's seen in his own practice, whatever that might be?
At least in Mercola's case, it would be made up because he doesn't have a practice. His only role now is running his website, selling supplements, providing health information without seeing individual patients. But the fact that he is a doctor and an osteopathic physician is a real doctor, that bolsters his credentials and makes his claim seem more believable. But any clinician worth their stripes would ask, where's the data? Where's the randomized clinical trial that proves that works? Because anecdotal claims, little case studies, that's not going to prove that a treatment is truly effective. We saw that with things like hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, where doctors have used anecdotal evidence and promoted that over something much more robust, like the vaccines had to go through. The vaccines had to be tested on tens of thousands of people to prove their safety and efficacy before they were authorized. And if you were promoting something like nebulized hydrogen peroxide, that's what you would need to do to prove those claims.
You know, I wonder if this is saying a lot about how we as humans process information that we want to believe. Because to be frank, using anecdotal evidence without adequate context, first of all, is something that social media is perfectly positioned to amplify, right? Because we're talking about short, emotionally satisfying pieces of information, right, John? So like, that's the kind of thing that's more likely to spread to begin with, both by virtue of human psychology and by virtue of the deliberate design of these social media platforms. But I also wonder, I mean, to be frank, bad journalism also frequently privileges individual anecdotes as evidence for why a certain story is worth your time to read. We all do it. We're not doing bad journalism here at On Point, but the idea that an anecdote can grab someone's attention and convince them to spend some time engaging with the story you're trying to tell is a very common practice. So I wonder how can we tell what the intent is here when it comes to what can separate good information from bad information? Do you see what I'm trying to get at?
I think what you're trying to get at is, you know, if you're dealing with a source that's providing health misinformation or health information in general, look at what their motivation could be. Ask them, are they trying to sell you something? In this case, right, Mercola is trying to sell you something. And if their profit comes from selling supplements or selling the things they're talking about, or even just making – the the information kind of the misinformation really their sole source of profit. Like you subscribe to their website, you get exclusive information, even exclusive consultations or opportunities to ask them questions. They're kind of pulling you in and making you believe that they're the only one you can trust. But that's the way they're making money off you. Whereas doing something in a larger clinical trial is providing robust proof of a treatment's safety and efficacy. And it's going to be reviewed and distributed by people who do not have a direct profit motive in it. The people who peer review the study at a major medical journal or the journalists that report on it responsibly, they don't have that same motive that Mercola has.
Right. So follow the money. Always a key way to sort of discern good information from bad. And by the way, earlier you said that I think you might have accidentally misspoken because I think you said that Mercola has a net worth of $100,000, but it's $100 million. Just
right. I'm underselling it. Yes.
Yeah. It's okay. Live radio. We all occasionally have a slip here. Listeners know that it happens to me frequently, almost every day. So we've talked about the groups and the individuals who were anti-vaccine prior to COVID. We've talked about the people who have these deep financial motivations for spreading disinformation. What sort of the other, like there's a third group here also, and those are sources or accounts associated with individuals who have political motives for pushing back against the COVID vaccine. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, we've seen a lot at NewsGuard of overlap between the sites that pre-pandemic would have focused on political misinformation that dove headfirst into promoting false claims about the pandemic, about vaccines, and whether it's hard to tell whether their motivation is simply driven by, okay, this is where the conspiracy theorist headspace is moving towards because the pandemic was affecting everyone's lives. You couldn't possibly ignore it, even on the worst of the worst bad news websites. But we saw a lot of overlap between those two worlds. In fact, 80% of the hundreds of sites that NewsGuard had identified on its coronavirus misinformation tracker, which is the list we kept of every single site where we found COVID misinformation, it got up into the 400s by early this year. 80% of those had shared misinformation before the pandemic, and that included political misinformation. And we also saw a lot of overlap between sites that shared misinformation about the pandemic and then pivoted back to sharing misinformation about the 2020 election, after early November and into January.
Interesting. Well, this hour we are talking about the small number of individuals and groups, tiny number really, that are responsible for the vast majority of anti-vaccine disinformation on social media. And I'm joined today by John Gregory, who's walking us through who those groups are and why they're doing it. So, I mean, if you had a quick list of maybe like the top five or six names or accounts that you would flag here, what would they be? Because I'm hoping to give listeners some tools of like if they see these names or accounts on their social media feeds to know to be warned.
For the strictly health side, the ones that would be flagged are Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Children's Health Defense, Joseph Mercola and some of the groups he funds, like the National Vaccine Information Center, which might sound like from its name an innocent vaccine information nonprofit when really it's one of the longest running anti-vaccine groups, and their own website, which is called The Vaccine Reaction. And then when you get over to the more politically motivated side or the ones that mix their health conspiracies and their political theories, that's names like Mike Adams at Natural News or more well-known spreaders of misinformation like Alex Jones of InfoWars, the man who goes by the alias Tyler Durden at Zero Hedge, and then bigger conservative, largely conservative sources like Newsmax, like Gateway Pundit.
Okay. So a good list there to sort of keep in our pockets to have our eyes on when we're all on our social media feeds. But John, I've frequently thought that one of the reasons why this disinformation can spread so quickly is that does much of it actually begin with a kernel of truth? And that then the sort of the surrounding context around that kernel gets immediately stripped away. But the kernel of truth that remains, and it's quite powerful. Like, for example, I've seen a lot of posts on social media that point to data coming out of the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, or VAERS, which is run by Health and Human Services in this country. And it's this large database that supposedly keeps track of all adverse events related to vaccine. And so they data is pulled from there, which is real and accurate, but then it balloons into something else. So is that part of the picture, the story here?
It can be. VAERS reports will be one example where they're misconstruing, misrepresenting, and really grossly misrepresenting the evidence that they have. Because saying there's a kernel of truth might imply that it might oversell it on certain myths, because there's always a bit of evidence, at least most of the time, there's a bit of evidence. It's not just made up out of whole cloth. But that kernel of truth or that evidence often doesn't say what the sites or the accounts that we're talking about say it does. So when it comes to VAERS, VAERS is an example of when they're misrepresenting and removing the context from this evidence, because VAERS is a large early warning system that collects all the information on any adverse event reported after vaccination, but does not prove that the adverse event, the death, the hospitalization, the illness was caused by that vaccine. And by taking individual reports and removing that context, you're then making it seem like, oh, look at all these deaths, look at all these serious illnesses caused by vaccines, when that count is going to include things that haven't been verified, that can be submitted by anyone without providing a name or contact information by which the CDC or FDA would verify it. And by design, it's going to include things that lack any plausible link to a vaccine, like someone dying in a car accident on the way home from getting their COVID shot. That is counted in VAERS. That doesn't mean that the vaccine caused their car accident.
Okay, so John, I want to stick with this for another couple of minutes, because it's really important. Like, I am on the VAERS website right now. It's through the CDC. And it says right here on the VAERS website, again, this is the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, that reports are accepted from anyone. That's what it says right here, and can be submitted electronically at this particular link. So first of all, that's what you're saying. It's not as if all these reports are coming through doctors or hospitals. Like, I could get on there right now and submit a report, and it would show up in the VAERS database, even if CDC hasn't had time to verify it?
Absolutely, and that's by design. They want the largest data set possible, because what VAERS can be helpful for is identifying very rare, potentially serious adverse events that couldn't have possibly been picked up in a clinical trial, when you're talking about those 1 in 1 million, 1 in 10 million sort of adverse events. You're not going to get that even when you're testing 30,000 people. It might be missed. And so it's a noisy system by design that accepts everything because they want the earliest warning system, but then that needs to be tested further. That needs to be go through different systems with different levels of verification in order to prove causation. It can't, a VAERS report can't do that on its own.
Okay, but CDC does actually, do they go through and verify the reports eventually that come into VAERS?
When it's a serious event and or a death report, yes, they do. But there's also the caveat that people can submit those kind of reports without the information that the CDC would need to follow up on it. As I mentioned before, you can submit to VAERS without a name, without contact information, without really enough information for them to figure out who you are, where this happened to you, and that's still going to be included.
Okay, so here I am on VAERS. I just can't help it. It's really fascinating. It's actually a little harder to get through than I thought. But and I was just selecting on all the COVID-19 vaccines. And let's see if I can do it here in 1 minute. Because I was doing this the other day in terms of the reports. And there are thousands of reports regarding the COVID vaccine, including deaths as well. But not, as we need to emphasize, not directly attributed to the vaccine, but reported in this system. So this is just one of the ways in which a little kernel of, I don't know if you want to call it truth or fact or information, then gets stripped of context and twisted and spreads through social media as disinformation about vaccines. So, John Gregory, stand by here for a second. We're going to talk a lot more about what to do about pushing back against this anti-vaccine disinformation when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about the tiny number of people and accounts on social media who are responsible for the overwhelming majority of anti-vaccine disinformation that's out there. And we're talking about what effect they're having. I am joined today by John Gregory, who's deputy editor of health at NewsGuard. It's an organization that examines the accuracy and trustworthiness of 6,000 websites around the world. And John, I really hate it when I myself am not precise with the information that I am putting out there, so I couldn't help it. During the break, I went back into VAERS, because we were talking about the vaccine adverse event registry that's run by the CDC, and some disinformation, vaccine disinformation, pulls data from VAERS and strips it of context and sends it out into the wild, if I could say. And as you said, anybody can put information in this database, and it takes a while for CDC to verify it. And it doesn't necessarily even have to be, the adverse event doesn't have to be at all associated directly with a vaccine. But when you see the official name VAERS as a source for some of this information, it seems kind of scary. And, you know, for example, I finally got the information up here. Search for all adverse events in VAERS under the COVID-19 vaccines category, and there are right now 2,259 deaths here. But the person could have died of anything, right? I mean, like, especially since the initial folks who got vaccinated in the United States were largely senior citizens who urgently needed the COVID vaccines. They may have died of any other cause as well. And interestingly, right below death, someone has reported the death of a pet related to the COVID-19 vaccine. So that's a little more context there about how to begin to think about what to do when you see information that's pulled from VAERS. So I just wanted to put that out there because I didn't like how inaccurate I was before the break here. So the question is, though, is how to push back, how to begin to push back against this disinformation. And so in order to get some insight into that, we talked with someone who right now is asking individuals why they believe what they believe about COVID. And that's Frank Luntz. He has actually been an influential and well-known Republican pollster and political communications consultant for more than 20 years. And now he's conducting focus groups for the de Beaumont Foundation, a public health advocacy group, to better understand how people view the COVID vaccines. And in those focus groups, Luntz says he hears a lot of disinformation from people who were once vaccine hesitant, but now he calls them vaccine rejectors.
When I present them with the truth, with the facts from the CDC or from the National Institute of Health or other organizations, they will often counter me with things that they've read on the web or with things that their cousin or their best friend or their colleague at work told them. And one of the greatest challenges right now is cutting through that clutter.
Luntz says the degree to which people are rejecting vaccines is profound. Frustrated responses from family and friends and in the media are not helping.
You're not going to get people to get vaccinated by yelling at them. You're not going to convince them to do the right thing by insulting them. Please accept their hesitation. Accept their skepticism. It may be derived from the wrong reasons. It may be because of misinformation. But if you simply just dismiss them because you know their information is wrong, you will not be able to reach them, communicate to them, convince them, and they won't end up doing the right thing.
Now, of course, Frank Luntz has spent his career helping craft political messaging that sticks and sways. And in a sense, Luntz says his COVID vaccination focus groups reveal that what works for politics may also work for vaccination campaigns, messages that come from close sources that people trust.
And quite frankly, it's their own doctor. It's their own pharmacist. The thing that I started arguing for, begging for about 45 days ago, and some have done it, is for doctors to send out a 60-second video to their patients, asking them, begging them, giving them the information necessary for them to get vaccinated. And then about 2 weeks after that, I added their local pharmacist, because between the two of them, one of them will have an ability to cut through all this clutter, all this misinformation. So the messenger is absolutely essential.
And Luntz says that's a key finding in a new report he's about to release.
In our most recent polling of parents, we found that providing vaccines in their doctor's offices would make them most likely to get their kids vaccinated. And this is another reason why the medical community is at the center of fighting successfully this misinformation and disinformation campaign.
That's Frank Luntz, longtime GOP pollster, political and communications consultant, who's now holding focus groups on people's views of the COVID-19 vaccine, or vaccines, I should say. John Gregory, I just want to get a quick response from you on what you hear in what Frank Luntz is saying.
I think his strategy has some validity, a kind of a community-based strategy that can convince people where just throwing a study at them, throwing the words of health authorities, isn't going to have as much impact as a trusted family member, a doctor, a pharmacist who they've had a personal relationship with for years. In fact, I think one of the better ways that has convinced people who are truly on the fence, the truly vaccine hesitant rather than hardened vaccine refusers, is just the fact that if their family members or their friends have gotten vaccinated and none of these terrible things that anti-vaxxers have said are going to happen have happened, that can convince people to get off the fence a lot quicker than, you know, a Dr. Fauci, the CDC, President Biden saying it.
Well, John, hang on here for just a second, because I now want to bring into the conversation Camille Francois, Chief Innovation Officer at Graphica, a group that analyzes the spread of information on digital platforms. Camille, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
So, first of all, it would seem that the deliberate spread of disinformation is actually ought to be a violation of the terms of service for these social media companies. So why are so many of these accounts still active?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I will say, first, we usually make a difference between what we call disinformation and misinformation. For disinformation, we think about people who are sharing falsehoods with an intent to deceive. And so, for instance, I am sharing, the wrong place and time for an election event in order to suppress your vote. So in disinformation, you have an intent to deceive. And in misinformation, we talk about falsehoods that are propagated by people who actually believe in them and do not have an intent to deceive. And those two, concepts, while it can be difficult sometimes to look at a piece of information and understand the intent of the person who's sharing it, they actually do warrant different types of responses. Over the past year and a half, we have seen platforms step up and take their role in tackling health misinformation much more seriously. It used to be the case that they were quite lax on those policies. You could share a lot of harmful, false information, and it, people would just platform would just look the other way. So now there are a lot more policies in place, and they are enforcing it. Twitter, for instance, is now releasing a regular transparency report on all the coronavirus and vaccine mis- and disinformation that they're taking down on their platforms.
Well, it's interesting, though, because clearly, though, it's not enough. Is what I'm saying. And how much of the fact that this let's focus on the disinformation, which can then later turn into as misinformation as other people who genuinely believe it help spread it. They're linked, right? I understand that they're distinct, but they're also linked. How much of the persistence of it is due to the fact that it produces a lot of engagement for Facebook, for Twitter, et cetera? And they don't want to do anything. They really do not want to do anything to reduce that engagement.
The engagement question is also tied to design questions, right? How are the way the platforms currently being designed making this problem worse? It's true that anti-vax disinformation and misinformation, for instance, is often propagated by these super spreaders who are very dedicated to their cause. And they write posts that are inflammatory and that are scary, and they write a lot of them. And unfortunately, more often than not, the way our social media platforms are designed does encourage that and continues to amplify this. That's one of the issues. And of course, the other issue here is we see audiences responding to these enforcement strategies by the platform. So with our colleagues at the Virality Project, for instance, we recently published a post with University of Washington Center for an Informed Public researchers that talk about all the ways the anti-vaxxer community online are changing the way they communicate to avoid detection and to avoid being taken down. So it could be, for instance, creating cryptic hashtags or changing the way you spell vax or vaccines or sharing screenshots or coded language and all of these. So it is a dynamic sort of playing field where you have both design issues, right, structural issues, and then you also have audiences that are thinking quite strategically on how they're going to continue putting their messages out there without being taken down.
Oh, that's interesting. Now, we have seen that there have some actions by these social media platforms have been effective. I mean, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. told NPR back in May that I think this was after he got taken off of Instagram. He told NPR that he has to post unicorns and kitty cat pictures on Facebook and doesn't want to give them an excuse to take him off of Facebook. So some efforts there have been effective. And we did reach out to Facebook for a comment, and they said, quote, "We permanently ban pages, groups, and accounts that repeatedly break our rules on COVID misinformation. And this includes more than a dozen pages, groups, and accounts from these individuals." That's what a Facebook spokesperson said. But I do want to just ask also, could these companies be doing more? Because, look, I have been told that lots of internal studies have been done, particularly at Facebook, where they find that for a minute loss, like a fraction of a percent in time spent on the platform, is all it would cost them to reduce, you know, misinformation or disinformation by, you know, double digits, by something like 20%, but they will not take those steps.
Platforms absolutely can do more. And I think that now we're having a policy conversation about that. It started in July with the U.S. Surgeon General advisory saying that health misinformation is an urgent threat and really calling for tech companies and social media platforms to step up. When we think about everything they can do, we tend to first think about the information they can remove from their services. And that's a very important part of it. As we said, when we have super spreaders that constantly break the terms of services, it's important to be able to remove this information. But on top of just removing information, we need to ensure that platforms can proactively address what we call the information deficits, right? So for instance, there is this concept called a data void. And data void is when you have a very specific, perhaps sentence, perhaps keyword that only makes sense to a certain community. And so for instance, where they're going to go and search for that specific phrase, they're going to enter a world of information where all the information might be misleading and harmful, and where they're not going to be exposed to fact checks or to helpful and accurate information. And so thinking strategically about how do you push the right information out, either again by fixing the design of some of these services, by doing proactive announcements and annotating posts, or by empowering influencers, that's also very important. The last thing I'll say on platforms is, of course, we need a robust research community that's able to understand how these mis- and disinformation campaigns spread and how they're impacting people. And in order for us to have that, we need platforms to ensure that researchers can have access to the right data to study these issues and help understand and inform how mis- and disinformation affects people and our society.
Well, John Gregory, we've got just 30 seconds left here. I want to give you a last shot at this. Is there anything the people who, the individuals who make up these billion plus strong social media networks can do to push back against disinformation?
I think they can look at the sources and the history of those sources, because it's extremely predictive that if they've shared misinformation before the pandemic, all the way back to, you know, have they spread 9/11 conspiracy theories, things like that, that correlates very strongly with sharing misinformation about the pandemic, and means they're going to share misinformation in the future. And it's something that Facebook and the other platforms could have taken action on, because we knew where this misinformation was going to come from.
Well, John Gregory, Deputy Editor of Health at NewsGuard, thank you so very much for joining us today. And Camille Francois, Chief Innovation Officer at Graphica. Camille, thank you so much as well. And I want to take the last minute of today's show to close with a fact that we here at On Point simply must accept. Today, we say goodbye to our producer and director, Anna Bauman. She's leaving us for the Windy City and Chicago. Let me tell you, you are so incredibly fortunate. Anna is one of our most talented producers. She's creative. She's smart. She's compassionate. She's the force behind some of my favorite shows we've done, from our moving conversation with Rodney King's daughter to a show she produced last year where we explored with an astrophysicist and a neuroscientist how humans perceive time. Because remember that part of the pandemic where we were all like, what day is it? So Anna Bauman, what is time? What is time? Anna, I will miss you so very much. I'll miss your mind, your heart, your empathy. Being able to work with you has made me a better journalist, and I cannot wait to see how you conquer the world of journalism and help us all be better people in your next steps. We'll miss you a lot, Anna. Thank you so much for being part of our team. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.